Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, that guy over there, Tim Dennis. Welcome to February. Thank you for joining us today. We've got a great guest in line for you. And Tim, you know, as I'm going through all these myriads of guest ideas and topics, it's been a while since we've talked about this. And what a fascinating read, just this little biography I was given on our next guest, and started digging a little deeper, and I thought, boy, this might be something. Again, at this state of the state, in the way the world is being held, sometimes we forget to kind of take stock of who we are, and take stock of the moments that we do get the chance to be alive and be here. Charles Gardner is the author of a book, Always Remember This Moment. And this book talks about his life and near-death experiences and what all took place during this time. Charlie, thank you so much for coming on to spend a little time with us today.
Hey, it's good to be here, Dave.
Let's. I want to kind of introduce you to our audience and give them a chance to know you. So let's talk about your life leading up to this moment when you had your near-death experience. What was your life like, Charlie? Where did you grow up?
You know, I grew up in eastern Tennessee in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. And, yeah, I'm just a regular guy. I'm not too one way or the other. I I'm an engineer by trade. I work in the construction industry. And I'm kind of more bent towards scientific reasoning and things like that. Not ever been too much into the supernatural stuff, but as it turns out, you know, I got a good feel for it now. But you know, I grew up in in the '60s. I was during the social unrest at that time, with the hippie movement and the Summer of Love out in San Francisco. But in the mountains of Tennessee, I grew up a redneck and a hippie. So, needless to say, I was a little bit confused as to what I was and what I wanted to do, but, I had a good family. Good, family values were church going people, but, I had that, experience with the church and, you know, having Christ come into my life and all of that. But as a lot of us do, kind of turned towards the worldly clamors and turned away from the church and started walking down the path of, drug addiction and alcohol abuse, and I wanted to leave home at an early age and go to San Francisco because that's where everything was happening. So that, that's kind of what started off my journey, but it has come full circle. So that was kind of the early stage, what it was like.
When you're living this life and you're, you know, kind of in that era, as you're experimenting and living and exploring new things, had the supernatural ever, now that you look back at it with 2020 hindsight, did the supernatural ever kind of play a role in your life?
You know, it's funny because in my book, I talk about earthquakes and miracles. It's the first chapter that I kind of made the analogy because by the time I wrote the book, I was living in California and I said, you know, it's kind of analogous to every day there are earthquakes in California. And I think when I was writing the book, on that day, there were 17 earthquakes in Northern California that day. Sometimes they're so small that you don't notice them. Every now and then, a big one comes along, kawam, and you can't help but notice them. I said, miracles are a lot like that, too, that, you know, they're happening all around us all the time. Most often we don't notice it. Like, you know, there are examples like, you know, that red light that took too long that kept me out of that accident up ahead. Was that just luck or coincidence or divine intervention? Early in life, I mentioned that, you know, I used to, as a kid, we had not gone to the moon yet. And being scientifically inclined, I used to look up at the moon and said, you know, one day we're going to go to the moon and there's going to be, you know, a confluence of the discussion between religion and science. And it's all going to come together. And, you know, I talk about in my early conversion, when I accepted Christ, it was a typical summer camp. I was like 12, 13 years old. It was on July 20th, 1969. And kind of walking around, the summer camp and kumbaya, all that stuff, pretty typical for a teenager in Tennessee at the time. You know, really, you know, taking notice of the beautiful things in nature. And, you know, the sky was a little bluer and the pine scent was a little bit more crisp. We got a call to go into the camp counselor's cabin. There was something going on TV. And we get to the cabin, we turn on the TV, and there's Neil Armstrong stepping on the moon for the first time. And it was kind of like an aha moment, like, wow, this is coming true, you know, science and supernatural events, you know. And so I've had many, many miracles in my life, some of which were kind of obvious, but some of which were just kind of taking place behind the scenes, you know. I got in, you know, as I traveled through this downhill path of hedonism and debauchery, you know, I had fun for a good part of the time, but then it became fun with some problems, and it just became problems. But all the while, you know, I had a guardian angel looking after me. I had more than this one near-death experience. I was involved in a head-on collision on a place called Devil's Slide, just outside of, just south of San Francisco. And it was knocked down backwards over a K-rail, looking 1,000 feet down at the water, saying, this is it. I'm going over. I'm going to die. And yet I didn't. You know, the car came down on the right side of the K-rail, so to speak. I thought it was on fire, but it turned out it was just kind of like the, you see in a rock and roll show, the dry ice that kind of cascades down over the stage. I was having that in my truck. Turned out it was the mechanisms that shoot the passenger airbags. And but I was able to squeeze out of like a 4-inch door opening that was jammed up against the K-rail and got out. And it was just a whole another world type of experience. It's kind of like if you watch the movie Saving Private Ryan, when they hit the beach in Omaha Beach, it was all black and white and in slow motion. And the other, the guy that had, you know, hit me head on, his wife had come through the windshield and was bleeding profusely from a cut in her throat. And it was just like, get her off the truck. I could hear peripheral, you know, crashes going on, people crashing into each other because they're stuck on a foggy day on the coast of California and didn't see the wreck up ahead. And by the time we got her off the truck and into a ditch and was trying to keep the blood from coming out, then the color and, you know, regular speed came back. I come to find out later that was just an overload of your senses, that's normal to happen when you go into shock. But as far as miracles and noticing miracles, you know, there were just so many that happened around my near-death experience. My friends said, Charlie, you got to write about this. This is too unbelievable to not be some type of, you know, divine providence. So, you know, all through life, I think, you know, I was hell-bent on killing myself, but there was something watching over me that kept me from doing that because I needed to have these experiences.
It's funny, isn't it? When you look back at a life, at any life,
and you start to pay attention to the moments, the little highlights, it's all in how you look at them. What, as you said, was this coincidence? Was this a miracle? Was it happenstance? But when you start to get the bigger spectrum of it and you look at each piece individually, it is kind of a myriad of miracles that line up to get us to the points in our lives that we're at. And you know, again, you can look at it as a glass half full, right? Or you can look at it as the glass half empty. And, you know, ascribing the miracle term to it, I'm all for it, right? Because I do think we don't give enough credit to real kind of magic that takes place on a daily basis around us.
Yeah. Or if you look at it from an engineer's perspective, the glass is built twice as big as it needs to be.
Right. So it's just what a crazy, crazy life, really, you know, for any of us. And I, you know, as I'm getting older, I sit there reflecting back at points and yeah, you could start to see this interesting narrative play itself out. And the story of your life and just how touched different things were. And then I'm sure you kind of get that viewpoint as well, where then you can not only see just the amazing little bits through your life, but then you start to see how your connections to others has influenced things. Oh, and that's got to be pretty rewarding too. That's why, you know, just the title of your book alone, I thought was pretty impressive. Always Remember This Moment, because those are the things that we tend to lump in with everything else that goes on. And we forget the special nature of each one of these individual experiences and moments that we get a chance to live.
Absolutely. And you know, I'd be happy to share with you how I came to that title in the book, which was kind of a miracle
sure.
in and of itself, but not to get too ahead of myself or this discussion, but is you one of the things I did is, you know, I talked about going down the path of drugs and alcohol addiction. I came to the point where I got sober 23 years ago, because I was at the point that where if I didn't do something, you know, I was going to die. And I like to say for years, my sobriety date was tomorrow. You know, I knew I had a problem. I knew I needed to do something about it, but I'll do something about it tomorrow. And one of the things in recovery is that you take an inventory. You look back and here are the things, here's the resentments that I had, here's the people, places, and things that, you know, caused me to. So do an inventory. And one of them was on a topic of relationships. And, you know, I've been really blessed with, you know, some really good women in my life and some, you know, good love experiences. But I also screwed a lot too. And, you know, what? And kind of the general mode was I would be so convinced that I'm doing God's will, that he meant for me to be with this woman. And, you know, she's the perfect one. When in all reality, it was 180 degrees off. And I would end up getting hurt. We would have a, you know, a shattered relationship. But then looking back on it, every single one of them, I learned, you know, some really in-depth life lessons. And that if I just took the time to listen, which is a common male attribute, not listening, but if I just saw those signs, you know, then, and this is all through from high school on up to, you know, just a few years ago, and I've been fortunate that most all the girlfriends, we still get along, we made up, we stay in touch, we still have a, you know, that good will for each other. But boy, did I screw things up, you know, doing that, because it's mostly just selfish pride that was keeping me from, you know, really fulfilling those needs and wants. But, you know, as we like to say, God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. As I look back on it and really learn those lessons, you know, the woulda, coulda, shoulda, become apparent, but every time it made me a better person going forward. And I'm really lucky to have a lot of really close friends. You know, I don't have a whole lot of friends, but you know, the ones I do have, you know, I'd take a bullet for, they'd take a bullet for me. And it became more true and evident as I really had those challenges like this near death experience.
When you're doing, a life review, kind of as you're doing, putting it down in the book form, and it forces you to kind of re-examine different aspects of your story. were there some surprises that, you know, memory kind of re-stimulated and brought back to you, thoughts, ideas, concepts from before all of this took place that, that really kind of stand out?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Let me tell you a little story of, you know, beyond this life we know as reality. I had an experience when I was a little kid. We would go to my grandparents' house in the summertime in Atlanta, Georgia. And my grandma developed cancer and was going down and down and getting worse. And we would go in and visit her in her room each night. And just, there was one night that came along, we just kind of knew that this is the night, you know, she's, in fact, my younger brother, Ellis, just, you know, he's so young, of course, there's no filter on his voice. He goes, "Mom, is Grammy, is Mommy going to be dying tonight? You know, shh, don't say anything." And I was staying with my mom in the room next door. And during that evening, I heard a commotion, things going on. I kind of woke up and there's my grandma sitting at the foot of my bed. I'm going, "Mommy, what are you doing up?" And she said, "Shh, be quiet. I got to go somewhere. And where I'm going, you can't come. But I just wanted to let you know that I love you. And I want you to look after and take care of your mom." And I go, "But Mommy, where are you going?" And she put her finger on my forehead. And I just went right back to sleep. And the next thing I know, I'm being woken up and they're taking my grandma out of a room in a gurney. She had passed away. And my mom's going, "Shh, be quiet, Granny. Mommy just passed away." But I know without a doubt that I got to see her before she went. And that still holds true today. So later on, when I'm about to die here, 9 years ago as it stands right now, I had these out-of-body experiences, and I know what my grandma was doing, and I know where she went. I had some that were before I went to see the white light and some during when I went to see the white light. Wow. And if you'd like to, I can tell you about those, too.
Well, right. Yeah. Certainly, we want to cover the whole gambit for you. But
yeah,
I'm curious now, in having this ghostly sighting of your grandmother, do you remember, was she as clear as your mom? Or
oh, yeah.
Now that you think back at it, was there anything that would have told you that this was a spirit you were talking to?
Not until afterwards. I mean, I thought it was really her. I mean, mm-hmm. It was just as vivid as reality can be. I mean, you know, I was a little kid, but it was like, you know, that was her. I go, "Mommy, what are you doing up? You're supposed to be in bed." You know, shh. So anyway, to come current to where this near-death thing started happening is that we had planned a family reunion back in Tennessee because, like I mentioned, I grew up on Signal Mountain, and my younger brother, Ellis, the guy who was a kid asking, "Is this the night that Grandma's going to die?" He was his daughter was the lead in the summer play up here on the mountain. We have a little summer playhouse, and she was playing Belle in Beauty and the Beast. And so he was planning a family reunion around that so we could all go to the play. And I remember distinctly he had called up and said, "Hey, so are you coming back for the family reunion?" And I mentioned to him, I said, "Yeah, I've got a bit of a flu or a cold or something going on, but you know, hey, it's a family thing. So I will be coming back for that." And so I did, I flew back to Tennessee and we had the family reunion and all went to the play. And there's a little scene in there where we're playing golf at the country club. And, you know, I remember, you know, but my brother said, "Hey, since you're coming back here," and our mom had passed away the year before, and you had, you know, made me the executor of your, what I call meager estate, but take care of my stuff. He said, "Since you made me the executor, why don't you bring a list of all your accounts and passcodes and access into all your stuff, just in case, God forbid, I might need it 10 or 20 years from now." Miracle number one. Little did we know he was going to need it the following week. To access and exercise his power of attorney and all of that. Because what happened was I had the flu. I came back to Tennessee. We did the family reunion, went to the play. I was playing golf. I remember I made mention to my brother, here's miracle number two, as we're on the 17th green of the golf course. I said, the weather is July. It's not that bad. You hear about it being hot and humid and unbearable. This is really nice. Maybe I should think about buying a house back here when I retired. Brother Ellis just casually looks up, points over to this house. He goes, yeah, it's that one right over there. Oh, what do you mean? What are you talking about? He goes, well, that's the Smith's house. And they've been in there for 30 years. And, I'm a realtor now, and I'll probably get the listing. So when they move, I'll give you a jingle because I'll probably get that listing and give you an opportunity to buy that house. Okay. I didn't think much more of it. A couple years later, lo and behold, I get a text. Hey, the Smiths are selling their house. Do you want it? And, of course, I'd been through this ordeal, and, I was ready to really think about retiring. And so, anyway, I got the particulars on it. I was really impressed by the difference in pricing between Tennessee and California. I go, wow, I'll take it. But, anyway, as we were playing golf back then and the family reunion, my flu had progressed to pneumonia, and I didn't even know it. I mean, some call it walking pneumonia. I was sick. I was coughing. Didn't even know how bad it was, but it had progressed into pneumonia. I went to get on the airplane to fly back to California after the reunion, and I got in the airplane, and I guess you got up to altitude, and the pressure differential was such is that it got into my bloodstream and became septic. It became a disease that a lot of people know about called sepsis. And it's not too unlike the coronavirus, is that it's a bacteriological viral infection that there is no known cure for. It kills about 200,000 people a year. And they say if you catch it in the first 4 hours, you got a 1 in 4 chance of, correcting it and getting by. After 4 hours, nearly always fatal. Mm. And I had it. I went to sleep. I wandered around the airport in San Francisco for 26 hours.
Oh my God.
Before somebody calls 911 and they took me in and put me in a corner and pumped me full of morphine because, hey, guys like me don't make it. What happened was that, I went into a coma. I was in a coma for 6 weeks. I had 13 strokes. I was not supposed to make it. Miracle number three was just how they found my family. When I get to the hospital, I'm barely intelligible, can't speak, but they did what they call a wallet biopsy. In other words, they pulled my wallet, went through my stuff and found a business card of the company where I was working. And, so they called and said, hey, you guys know Charlie Gardner? And they go, yeah, he works here. And well, we need to get a hold of his next of kin because he's really in a bad way. Oh, what's wrong? Where is he? Well, we can't tell you that, with all these HIPAA, HISA, health rules. We need to talk to HR. And so HR gets on the phone. They say, well, let's look it up. And I hadn't updated my emergency contact. I had my mom as my contact who had passed away the year before. And so there's a saying, and it's in the book, but, I got my boss, who's this big, rough, tough construction dude with the division manager and his executive assistant. And they're sitting around the room, and this big, rough, tough guy goes, he's crying, literally crying. He's going, I know he's got some brothers back in Tennessee, but I don't know how to get a hold of him. And then, as luck or will or miracles would have it, executive assistant goes, well, he was at the stockholders dinner last year with his new Russian girlfriend. She's probably on the guest list of that dinner. Let me go look it up. She went and called it up. And sure enough, there was my girlfriend's name. And they looked her up on Facebook. And she was on Facebook, and it had where she worked and a phone number on Facebook. And they called her and got on, and she just happened to be working that day. And she answered the phone, and very stoic Russian lady, and I said, "Do you know Charlie Gardner?" And I go, "Yes." "What's wrong?" "Well, he's in the hospital." "Which one?" They can't tell us. Well, never mind. I will find out. Turns out she's a nurse. So she used her nursing contacts to find out what hospital I was in. Drove up from San Jose to San Mateo, where I was, and presented herself, "Hey, I'm here to see Charlie Gardner. Who are you?" "I'm his wife." Well, he left explicit instructions not to let his wife in. He goes, no, that's his first wife. I'm his second wife.
Okay.
Thinking on her feet, right. See, you're still in your scrubs, so you're a nurse. So maybe you can help us get a hold of his family because we've got his phone here, but it's locked. And so Marina, was my girlfriend, took the phone, and a couple hours later, she unlocked the phone because she used an old code that we used that I had as unlocked the phone, and was able to get a hold of my brother. And, you know, and it was kind of a confluence of events because we had some mutual friends up in Lake Tahoe where I had a house, and she tried to call them, but, you know, they were in the South Pacific on a surfing safari. And, but by the time she unlocked the phone and called my brothers and my best friend in Phoenix, my other friend and from Lake Tahoe stopped in a little internet cafe off one small remote island off of Tahiti and, you know, got the message, "Hey, you need to call." And so they all confab and got together and started flying to California and comes to me. That's all the time, all the while I'm having those 13 strokes. It was, you know, in a bad way because your body reacts when you have sepsis and it's that toxic. Your brain starts shutting down all non-essential functions like my kidney and my liver. And, you know, I started eating away at my lungs and I just had ups and downs. You know, a lot of my blood pressure going up and down. That's what caused these strokes. So by the time my family got there, it was like they had been able to find my attorney. He produced my will, which had a do not resuscitate order. And so the debate began, you know, do we pull the plug or not?
Let me ask you this real quick, Charlie. Now, again, having the gift of hindsight, are you glad that you had a do not resuscitate order? Has that changed for you out of curiosity? Do you want to be brought back if it's possible or sustained?
Well, you know, I can laugh about that because I did modify the language a little bit because the do not resuscitate order is pretty cut and dry. I don't want to be left vegetable, pull the plug. But I modified the language because of the debate that went on at this time I do not want to be left a vegetable, pull the plug upon the concurrence of my co-executors. In other words, they got to say, okay, that's what he wants. That's going to go ahead and do it. Because my brothers, we're all engineers. They're pretty smart guys. You know, they were questioning the doctors in that, well, he's still got insurance, right? Yeah. It's still viable, right? Right. Well, let's just kind of wait and see what happens. And, of course, the debate back and forth where the doctors were saying, well, he's got an order, do not resuscitate. We can keep him alive. You know, we can poke holes and feed him through his stomach. We can poke holes in his throat and let him breathe. But then that negates the do not resuscitate order.
Right.
And so my brothers were like, okay, well, again, let's roll the dice a little bit. And let's just kind of keep it going as it is. But as it was that I was deteriorating and I was dying. I mean, they had blood cell counts and showed my white blood cells were going up, which meant my brain is preparing to die. And I'd had these strokes and finally I lost all brain activity. And the doctor said, look, you know, he's pretty much done. I had a neurologist and said, you know, if we were to pull the plug or take him off his breathing apparatus, we might get some brain activity, but maybe not. And if so, he's pretty much done anyway. So they made the decision on July 25th, 2011, pull the plug. In preparing for that, my former wife, Carrie, went and got the twins. You know, they were 14 at the time. They were and brought them in hey, it's time to say, it was like midnight and it's a school night, but you know, hey, they're going to pull the plug the first thing in the morning, but you know, gave them the opportunity. You need to go in and say goodbye to dad. Because he's probably not going to make it. And my son came in, gave him about 10 minutes or so. And he said what he needed to say. And here's miracle number. I quit counting by this time, but my daughter, 14-year-old girl, came in, and she'd been coming in every night for the last 6 weeks, but she was one of these precocious 14-year-old girls that would say, Mom, I'm not going to talk to dad until he can talk back. Huh. And when she would come in every night, hi, Dad, we're here, and go over in the corner and play your little iPad or iPod and just kind of zone out, because that's how he dealt with trauma. She just wanted to shut it out, wall it off. But this night she came in, and you know, my former wife explained to her, said, look, Kyla, this is the last chance you got. You need to say something to Dad, because we're pulling the plug in the morning and he's probably not going to make it. So this is your last chance to say goodbye. And she just cracked wide open. I mean, she started crying. You know, she had her 10 minutes or so with Dad alone in the room, and she started pleading, Dad, please don't go. Don't go. I mean, you promised me you'd give me my high school diploma since you were on the school board. And, you know, who's going to, you know, that's not going to happen. And who's going to walk me down the aisle when I get married? You know, Dad, please don't go. And by that time, I was having my third out-of-body experience.
Well, let's do this. Let's take a quick break. I mean, this is a lot to digest. We have to do a quick break. We'll come back and hear about your out-of-body experiences, the near-death aspect of this, and how it impacted you. What did you see? What did Charlie see? What did he live through? We'll find out more about that. Stay tuned. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. Always remember this moment. It's out and available. We've got a link up for the book in today's program guide. We also have a link to Charlie's website, alwaysrememberthismoment.com. So you can find both links, go order the book, make sure that you visit the website, get more information. All right, Charles Gardner, the author, said we can call him Charlie. So that's why I'm referring to him that way as we talk about this. All right, Charlie, so you're done. You're cooked. So it seems from the outside world. Now, during this time, were you conscious of what was going on around you, even though you were in this coma?
In a way, it's hard to describe. You know, the out-of-body experiences, the first ones were kind of pretty much typical to what you see or read on TV or read about as part of other people's journeys. I made it a point not to look at all of that stuff until after I'd written the book, because I didn't want to taint what my experience was. But, you know, my first experience out of my body was pretty typical. I'd floated up to the top of the hospital room and was looking down at me, and I'm going, gee, that's me on the bed there. What? I'm all puffed up, you know, what's wrong? You know, and there were people standing around looking down at me, and I was all puffed up like the Pillsbury Doughboy, because my kidneys had stopped and I, you know, wasn't passing fluids, and I was starting to literally puff up. They had me on a dialysis machine, I found out later. But then my second kind of awareness or out of body was that, you know, I floated up to the top. I'm looking down. I go, this is kind of wild. I mean, let me see if I can do anything consciously. And I flew over into the corner of the room and turned around, and I looked at the back of everybody standing around my bed, and I noticed one of my good friends, her daughter, was chastising her mom for rubbing my feet. Mom, don't rub his feet, you know. And she was like, oh, no, the doctors told us this is a way we can communicate with him. And, you know, I'm just doing this because, you know, he might feel it somewhere. And then my best friend Roger from Phoenix, Scottsdale.
Well, wait, one second. Now, as she's doing that, and you're kind of watching this play out like you're watching through a TV set, can you also physically feel anything? Can you feel her touching your feet? Can you feel yourself in the bed or the hoses or anything? No, okay. So no, you're no completely sensory. Kind of cut off from that sensory. Okay.
Yeah, and kind of further eliminate that in that my best friend Roger left to go downstairs to the cafeteria to get something to eat, and I followed him. I went out with him. I got on the elevator. We went down a floor, went to the cafeteria, and he was eating. And all the while, I'm yelling and waving, Roger, can't you see me? What's going on? I didn't do the thing, like if you remember that movie Ghost, where Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore and Patrick's a ghost, and he's trying to touch her, and he puts his hand all the way through her. You know, I didn't do that. I couldn't touch anything or touch anybody, but I was, you know, trying to yell and get Roger's attention. Nothing. Later on, after I had woke up and came to, I was explaining, hey, I had these out of body experiences and this, and there were some naysayers. There were, oh no, poo poo. You know, that was just the meds that you were on, or you had too much oxygen on the brain. I go, no, really, I was out of my body. I, you know, went up the roof, went in the corner, and followed Roger down the cafeteria. And somebody goes, okay, if you followed Roger down the cafeteria, what did he have to eat? I said, oh, that was easy. He had meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and green beans. And they turned to Roger and said, well, what did you eat down there? He goes, meatloaf, mashed potatoes, and green beans. Whoa. So when Roger and I got back up from the cafeteria, as soon as they opened the door to my hospital room, I sucked right back into my body. But I really couldn't feel anything. It was just, you know, kind of.
Let me ask you real quickly.
Yeah.
When you're following and you're doing this, I mean, are you seeing a physical form for you besides the one laying in the bed? Like, do you see a hand or an arm or legs as we would do as we look down and we can see us? Okay. So you could see that.
Just as if you're looking through your own eyes at what's going on. If you put your hand out in front of you, waving at somebody, you can see the hand. Yes, I could see my physical body, but it was in a spiritual form. It's kind of weird to explain, but you know, it kind of had a little, you know, kind of a shivering sheen to it, kind of stuff. Way to describe that. So anyway, when we get to the night before they're going to pull the plug, and my daughter's crying, Dad, please don't go. I had my last out of body experience, and that was what we call, and in the book called Floating Up to the Light. Because at that time I was leaving my body, and it's kind of like I'm sitting in a, the only way to describe that, in San Francisco at AT&T Park, the baseball field, there's a big catcher's mitt out in the outfield. And it's just, I mean, like it's really huge. And what it felt like to me is I was sitting in this catcher's mitt, just kind of laying back in a lazy boy type fashion and being lifted up towards this, as it's described in TV and the other near-death experiences. It was a white light. But for me, it wasn't a white light. It was more like the only way to describe it, a green disco ball. But it was radiating so much light and heat. I
thought, okay.
I mean, it's kind of funny. I mean, this is when I grew up. So, man, that looks like a disco ball. Wait a minute. That thing's so bright. It should be hurting my eyes. Why is it not hurting my eyes? Oh, wait a minute. I'm dying. I came to the realization, I'm dying. Why am I dying? What's going on? And as I'm lifting up and I'm going to this radiating source of energy, the green disco ball, these two, which going I can describe as angels, came by my side. And they were going, and what do angels say? Fear not. But they were going, don't worry, dude. It's going to be fine. You're going to a good place. Pretty soon, you know, you're not going to feel any pain. It's going to all be good. And I'm looking at him like, who are you? And, you know, one of them was kind of a white guy and the other guy was kind of a Middle Eastern guy. And I'm trying to look because they were really big. I mean, they're like 10 foot tall. And I'm trying to look over and look down to see how far it is down to their feet. I couldn't see that. But I'm asking them, I said, why am I dying? They, don't worry about it. You're okay. You know, and then as we're getting up there and getting close to this eminence of power, I call it, or the pearly gates, or however the description was, I knew I was passing over into the afterlife. And I knew, you know, I started feeling warm and like you're on a sunlit beach and waves were lapping at your feet. But I'm kind of trying to look around this green disco ball to see my mom or my grandma or, you know, people that have passed on before me. And then I heard my daughter crying back, way back behind me. Dad, please don't go. Don't go. Please don't go. And I kind of looked back and forth, and I know some kind of transaction took place, because right away I'm into what you see on TV is the wormhole. Big circular, round and round. You're falling through this wormhole, and boom, 20 seconds later, I'm waking up. Now, heaven time and earth time are not the same.
Okay.
Because for me, that experience was like 20 seconds. You know, I know some type of transaction took place. I don't remember the details, like, hey, it's not your time. You need to go back for a little while. We got things for you to do or whatever it is. But I know a transaction took place, because I go in the wormhole, 20 seconds later, boom, I'm waking up. Now, what happened on Earth is my daughter starts screaming, Mom, Mom, come quick. Dad's waking up, because my eyes start fluttering. You know, there's some booting up or a connection being made that, you know, my eyes start flittering and fluttering. And, you know, but I didn't wake up 20 seconds later like it was in my experience. It was, I just fluttered and nothing happened. You know, 3 days later, my eyes opened. You know, 3 days after that, I start tracking things in the room. And like 4 days after that, I finally came back into my body. So it's about a week and a half on Earth for what to me seemed like 20 seconds. And my first cognitive, you know, expression of being back in my body as I come to, there's my former wife and my current girlfriend, both in my face, big bright smiles on their face. Look, he's awake. He's awake. And of course, my friend Rogers, you know, you had the most surprised look on your face. Like maybe I died and gone to the wrong place and I was going to be in purgatory with these ladies look smiling down at me, picking at me or something. So we had a big laugh about that. But, you know, being intubated, I couldn't talk because I was, you know, had the thing down my throat. And, you know, I've been laying on my back for 6 weeks and I was completely atrophied. I couldn't move anything. And I was trying to call out. And, you know, and one of my brothers go, hey, he's trying to say something. What's he trying to say? Another brother engineer, the smart one in the family, Chris, goes, well, you know, let's get a doctor's stethoscope, put it up to his mouth. Maybe we can hear him. And he did. And I was asking, where's Kyla? Where's my daughter? You know, where's my daughter, Kyla? Oh, Kyla, your dad's calling. She comes bounding in the room. She's all happy, happy, happy. And I'm talking through the stethoscope going, what's wrong? Why are you crying? And she looks at me kind of quizzical. Oh, and then gives me the two thumbs up that millennials do. Oh, no, Dad, it's okay. Everything's good. You know, she realized that I was, you know, why are you crying? What's going on? Because she was saying goodbye to me. It's the last thing I remembered. So, you know, then starts the journey of recovery. I'm now, back in my body.
I'm curious. Yeah. You've had this pretty remarkable experience. It's all very real to you. Memories are just as real as this one that you and I are making right now, correct?
Correct.
When you come back, obviously you've suffered 13 strokes, you've been in a coma, you've got all this going on. Are those memories completely intact at that moment, or are they kind of fragmented as well as to what just happened to you?
Oh, no. It took a while to get back to reality. A couple things. There are some things that are still kind of fuzzy even today. Some of the things I saw on that journey to the green disco ball was I was able to see alternative worlds and lifestyles. I mean, it was I don't know much of the details other than it was a lot of universes and these big blue balls that were, you know, I was realizing, oh, these are like another world. This is another universe. And it was kind of like looking at those jumpy pins that kids have where you got all the big balls that you go play in and stuff.
Oh, the ball crawls, right.
Yeah, the ball crawl. And it was like each one of these balls was a different universe from a different world and had different lives. Some of them, you know, maybe I was in, maybe I wasn't, but I'm real kind of fuzzy, unclear on what all that meant. I think if I did pass over on the other side, it would have been revealed what all I was looking at. So that was kind of fuzzy. But equating the reality to the other side, here's a good example. When I came to, you know, I had this doctor coming in every day, checking up on me and said, hey, how you doing? I'm doing okay. I'm breathing air, not dirt. And he goes, yeah, well, there's going to come a time when you're going to need to choose a place to go to step down. Well, I was in step down at this time, just gotten out of ICU. And you're going to need focused rehab, and we'd like you to come to our place here. And I thought he's trying to sell me a bill of goods. And then he asked the question, do you know how you got here? And I go, you know, Doc, I'm a little fuzzy on that. Why don't you give me a day or two, because things are let come into focus, and maybe I can tell you. And he goes, okay. He comes back a few days later, so you have time to think about it. Yep, I got it. You know, I was getting sick. I was, you know, I had a connection in Atlanta to get to San Francisco, and I missed my flight. And I went to the bar, and I met these Saudi Arabian businessmen, and I hired them to take me on their Learjet to San Francisco, paid them $20,000. And it was a wild ride, because I got on the plane, and turns out that they were diplomatic couriers, and they had weapons on board. It was really a sketchy flight, but, you know, I made it to San Francisco, and everything worked out okay. And the doctor, looking incredulous, looks over at my brother and goes, is this true? And my brother goes, nope, not true. He was on the Delta flight. We have documentation that he was on that flight, and his luggage made it and got left in the luggage. You know. And we were shaking. Well, why was I thinking? I was so convinced that that was real, that that really happened. And we didn't find out for a few weeks that what had connected the two, because I remember in that experience, I was seeing the interior of the cockpit. And I was on the Learjet, and that's what kind of put two and two together for me. But in the way it went down is that my brothers took turns at watching over me and being my advocate, so they didn't screw up and kill me while in the hospital. And I had my three brothers, a couple of nephews, and you know, people who stay with me. And and the docs had told them to try to engage me and talk to me, and you know, keep, you know, because you don't know what I'm hearing or not hearing. And my older brother, Tommy, who was ex-Navy, Special Forces, somewhat connected with the other government agencies, he was actually on the phone one time with the Saudi prince. And, you know, he said, hey, you mind talking to my brother, Charlie? You want to talk to a Saudi prince? I've got him on the phone. You know, he just kind of yuck, yuck, you know, and he's asleep, but, you know. But that kind of triggered my mind as I'm seeing what was actually the devices that were monitoring my blood pressure and heart rate and all that stuff you see in hospitals. You know, I was imagining that as the interior cockpit of a Gulfstream. And by my brother asking me if I wanted to talk to a Saudi prince, that's where I put that whole story together in my mind is what actually happened. But it didn't happen. So.
Well, let me ask you this then, because and I hope you understand this and don't find it disrespectful for listeners then that are on the fence about what do they believe when it comes to near-death experiences. If it was that vividly real to you, that memory, that you could get that clear a description, how do you know that your near-death experience actually happened that way and it wasn't just the brain firing off in those last moments as oxygen was leaving it and all of the scientific claims that come with okay. What a near-death experience is?
I can answer that specifically. It's not the brain synapses. I can say without a doubt in my mind that there is a place that we go when we die. And for me, I can't judge others, but I think for most, it was a good place. It's an absolute, you know, like my life experiences, things not necessarily what I thought they were thinking it was, but it was a good plan for me. And the way I can say specifically in that one of my experiences that I had when I came to and I was learning to do everything over again, because I had to learn to do everything over again. My first feat was lifting my little finger up and down. And that was like a 2-hour workout. Then I lift my hand, my arm, move my arm, sit up, walk. You know, it was like great news. Charlie walked 30 steps today. This is great. And I had to learn like to walk and to feed myself and all that stuff. So as I got more into recovery again and acclimated, there were people bringing 12-step meetings into the hospital. I had a particular friend that sang in this group called the Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir. And I like to say that I'm living proof of the power of prayer, because I had a lot of my friends and family, church members and things like that, they were praying for me. But the specific example was a friend of mine singing in this Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir. Happened just to be one of the few white people in a traditionally black gospel choir from Oakland. He calls me up and goes, "Hey, Charlie, we're going to be singing in Half Moon Bay, and we're wondering if you could come by and have dinner with us before the show, because these people really like to meet the person that they were praying for." Okay, yeah, sounds good. Yeah, I sure be happy to. I'll show up. And I go, and of course, everybody's, "Oh, we were praying for you. So glad to see that you recovered." And, you know, all that stuff, pretty typical in a recovery story. But then I go to the show, and they're singing, and they came to this particular song that just floored me. I mean, and it was a song called "Hear My Prayer," which is about when your life here on earth is done, what happens. And it was just like, I'm sitting there just amazed, because, you know, I know I've heard this song before. Where did I hear it? And it came to me, I heard it when I was on the other side. And it's kind of like the angels singing "Glory to God" or whatever. But I heard that song. And so after the show was over, I went up to the choir leader, and I said, "Look, can I come backstage? I need to talk to the choir. This amazing, you know, experience." And, you know, and I went back there as they're getting ready to go. And I said, "You know, look, I know you guys are praying for me, and I really appreciate it. And I'm all back here, but you guys sang this one song, Hear My Prayer." And it just really resonated with me, because I hadn't heard it before tonight. But as I heard it, I knew I heard it when I was there on the other side. And one of the ladies from the choir goes, "You know, come to think about it, that night that we were praying for you was the night that we were rehearsing that song." And he's like, "Ooh,
wow." That shows you the true connectivity of all of us.
Yeah, exactly. So what do? Is they ask me, "Hey, every year we're coming back here, we'd like you to introduce this song." And of course, me, I kind of play it up a little bit. You know, it's like, "Hey, you guys want to hear what the angels in heaven sound like? Listen to this." And of course, Terrence, the choir leader, goes, "Gee, Charlie, can set the bar kind of high for us here." But part of that introduction is that, you know, I am living proof of the power of prayer. And there was that connection right there.
Now, so, obviously, you know, another part of the point I want our listeners to realize is that, you know, I posed the question to Charlie, how is he sure that it was real and not just what happens when the brain shuts down, as science tells us? He also told us that he followed the one gentleman down to the cafeteria and could specifically tell you what was on the plate. So that part wasn't a hallucination, because there was somebody on this side that could corroborate that this is, in fact, what took place. I just wanted to make that mention as well. So didn't feel like I was throwing you under the bus there, Charlie, but just asking questions I know our listeners would be curious about as well. Okay.
Well,
now,
it's always a great mystery, you know, what happens right on the other side. And you know, quite frankly, I didn't get to see it all, because after I wrote the book, and then I started, you know, I had a little stack of books that people would give me, "Oh, here, you ought to read this. It's about this lady that drowned in a river and she came back." And, you know, I had like 10 stories of, you know, going to see God and Jesus and, you know, and how, you know, that's all validated. And I had one story, this guy that drowned in a swimming pool, that he went to the dark place and he saw the devil sitting on a pile of gold or some kind of weird stuff like that. I don't, you know, and I'm not trying to say one way or the other, but I am a firm believer in my faith that I'd come back to when I got sober. It was validated in my experience and my near death and afterlife. I know without a doubt that there's a place that I go after I die, and it's a good place. And I can't wait to get back there again. In fact, I may have that opportunity here in the very near future. Tomorrow I'm supposed to go in for heart surgery. And my kids call and go, "Dad, aren't you afraid?" I go, no, not really, because it's really the medical technology as such. It's like taking your car into Jiffy Lube to get the oil changed. So I'm not worried there. And the other side, if I die, I know where I'm going. So, you know, just know I've lived a good life and I love you. And, you know, things are okay. It's all in God's time.
Yeah, Tim. So when I booked this interview with Charlie, I said, yeah, would you be able to record on Monday or Tuesday? He goes, well, let's do Monday because Tuesday I might be trying to die again. I'm like, all right, Charlie, that's an interesting take on it. No pressure there. So this might be the last interview for Charlie Gardner. You know, and if so, Charlie, we thank you.
Interestingly enough, though, ahead, Charlie, Tim. when my mom had when she had her bypass, she thought at one point or another, she thought she saw my stepdad, or she, at least she thought she felt him. So I would ask you this: when you go in to have your heart surgery, and maybe even when you had these experiences where you did have near death experiences, was there one person or a person that you were looking forward to seeing when you had these near death experiences, or even as you go into heart surgery, is there one person that you look forward to seeing on the other side?
Yeah, well, and as I explained, when I was going up to the green disco ball and getting closer, it was kind of like there's a story in the Bible where Moses was up on the mountain to get the Ten Commandments, and that God was passing by him, but it was such an intense power he could not look upon that. He had to turn his head, and that's exactly what I had to do. It was such an intense power, I couldn't look upon the green disco ball as we got closer. But what I was trying to do, like I explained, I'm trying to look around it to see my mom, my grandma, and my granddad, who had, you know, preceded me into this afterlife. And so, yeah, I knew she was there. I knew they were there. And I knew I was about ready to reconnect with them when my daughter screwed things up and called me back to this temporal world. So what happens then? You know, I come back. Everybody's saying it's such a miracle, you know, that you weren't supposed to make it, but yet you did. And here's the kicker. People are saying, well, God must have something big planned for you. Boy, that really confused me. You know, I'd sit in my jacuzzi at night and pray, God, show me what you want me to do, and I'll do it. Just show, and, you know, because I'm not a Mother Teresa type. I'm not going to sell everything and give to the poor and, you know, be utterly altruistic. I'm too selfish for that, but. But I was asking God to show me what, you know, what was meant to be for me. And, you know, I started to learn that in just little bits and pieces, dribs and drabs. And, you know, in some of the recovery books, it talks about, you know, a spiritual experience versus a spiritual awakening, that not everybody has that blinding white light, euphoric aha moment, that most of it's just a little bit of, a little bit of, oh, yeah, maybe that. And that was what it was like for me. What happened for me is start little by little. My former wife would call me up and said, hey, our daughter's playing in a water polo match over at the high school. You want to go? And, of course, me thinking about me, I go, well, I can't walk. You know, she says, nonsense. I got a wheelchair. I'll take you. Oh, okay. And I go up there, and I'm thinking more about, hey, don't get me too close to the water. I can't swim. But then I start noticing, here's my daughter with her high school friends playing and joking around, and the frivolity that they were having. I go, oh, this is what I came back for. I get to experience this. Another of my best friends was having his 50th birthday party, and his wife had rented out a bar with a band and had barbecue. And I got to see people I hadn't seen in 20 years, and, you know, both from Southern and Northern California. And of course they were all guffawing about, oh, what a miracle, what's so good to see. And I'm thinking, man, this is what I came back for, not the accolades, but to have another experience and see these people and enjoy my friend's 50th birthday party. And what I slowly started to realize, and kind of the punchline to all of this, is this life that we're giving is truly a gift. And, you know, we talk about yesterday's gone, tomorrow's not here. Having 2 feet right here, right now, is a gift. That's why we call it the present. But, you know, to me, it's more like you know, every experience that I have is like a fine brushstroke from a painter's painting. That every one we have is another stroke. But like a professional painter's painting, I had no clue what that experience is leading into until things starting to come together towards the end. And you get to see a beautiful creation, that this life is such a fragile tapestry of these brush marks of experiences, that we're meant to experience this thing here called life.
Can you
when we go to the afterlife, we've had that experience.
Can you tell me, coming back into essentially a broken body, broken in many different ways, was it hard? Did you wish to be back on the other side? You know, I've heard differing takes on that. I'd like to know what your thoughts were.
You know, at first I was just kind of stumbling and bumbling. My former wife, Carrie, and, you know, equated it to a very good description. She said, you know, it's like you're born again as a new baby. You know, your eyes got really big, dark pupils. It's like you're coming back. You're coming from the spiritual world back into the real world. And, you know, you shit and poop and do all this stuff. You cry a lot. You know, you have these emotions you're trying to get under control. And it's just, you know, you're just learning to do all this stuff over again. So you're transitioning from a spiritual body to a physical body. And yeah, there were a lot of times I was like, man, I'd just as soon be back over on the other side. And then I would go back to the step-down nursing place or the ICU room, and I would see and I remember what it was like to be all hooked up and I couldn't sleep and I'm getting bothered every 2 hours. And I'm thinking, maybe I really don't want to be there. But in essence, I really look forward to getting back to that place on the other side. It's just that I got to let it happen in its own way, in its own time. I mean, I like to laugh and say, I got to get there legally, because if I take matters in my own hands, I may go see that dark side and the guy on top of the gold
coins
or whatever. You know, so I want to do it right. But still, there's been several things I've been able, you know, to share my experience of this near death and talk to people like what that's like. And yeah, I was, you know, basically coerced into writing this book, but then it got me into a whole different realm. I mean, like, I'm an engineer, I'm a construction guy. I like facts and scientific proof, you know, and all this, you know, afterlife stuff is kind of foo-foo-y for a guy like me, but I've come to believe that there's a lot of truth to that. From going back to when I would be looking at the moon and saying, someday we're going to be landing on that moon, to today, you know, I can look people in the eye and say, look, I can tell you that I am living proof of the power of prayer. Now, I've had, like, yesterday, I got the news that a real dear close cousin of mine has been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and she's not going to make it much longer. And I was able to spend some time and share with her on the phone my experience, and that, you know, hey, you know, there's nothing we can do about this. None of us are going to get out of this thing alive. So you might as well try to go with the most grace and dignity that you can, because you can't pick the time. You know, that's in somebody else's hands. But enjoy the time that you have and be a good, you know, a good leader for those that are going to follow behind you. So, and when your time does come, you can go with the amount of grace and dignity. Another example.
Sure.
My mom, you know, I'm a mama's boy. There's no doubt about it.
Okay.
They had a very strong, Southern, dignified lady, Georgia Peach, raised in the South, and, you know, nothing more than a finishing school education, but she had to learn to raise 4 boys when Dad and her got divorced when I was 9 years old. But she was a very well-respected and dignified lady. She had preceded me into recovery. We come from a long family line of alcoholics, and, you know, she finally, you know, my granddad tried in the 40s, but didn't make it. He died a drunk, but my mom was able to get sober a couple of years before me. I was trying to get me to, you know, get sober, but I wouldn't have nothing to do with it. But she got the cancer, and she passed, and I was able to get sober a couple of years after her. And she and I got to enjoy this thing called sobriety for a while, and you know, it's kind of funny because I'm going through these steps and stuff. I go, Mom, what step are you on? And then in her, you know, if you could imagine, like from the movie Gone with the Wind with, what was her name? Scarlett O'Hara.
Right.
In recovery. Right. The Wachali, I'm on that step where you have to go say you're sorry to everybody. And I figured if I just waited long enough, they'd all be dead. We would laugh about that. But when she passed at her funeral, the pastor came up and she said the most eloquent thing I think I've ever heard. And she goes, you know, we came to Mary Level the night before she died and asked her if there was anything that we could do, as if the living can do anything for the dying. And she looked at us and said in her sparkly-eyed kind of way, she says, no, there's nothing that you can do. There's no sin that I haven't confessed. There's no amends that I haven't made. I'm ready to go. And me and my three brothers were just sitting there in awe and crying and just going, man, that's the way I want to go. I want to be able to say there's no sin that I haven't confessed. There's no amends that I haven't made. I'm ready to go. And I think I was kind of saying it to my kids the other night. And then, hey, just, you know, it's like taking your car to Jiffy Lube. But just in case something were to happen and I were to get called home, just remember, your dad's had a really good life. I've had a lot of really good experiences. And I've had a lot of loves. I've had a lot of success in business. I've had a lot of setbacks and failures that I learned from, but I've always, you know, from that towards the end, I've learned a little bit of humility and grace and dignity and are able to help my fellow men, like my cousin. You know, yeah, you're going to die. That's a fact. We're all going to die. But just make sure you go in a good way. And she started sharing about, you know, I got to see my daughter get married. I got to cuddle my grandson. I've done everything that I want to do. So that's kind of, you know, that was kind of the lesson of all of this. And, you know, so what do I do? I learned the publishing business. So I write this book, and then now I've published another book. I've just published a book about my 40 years in the construction industry and the crazy stuff that happens on the job sites. And that's a whole nother realm of stories that maybe we can do an interview later.
Let me ask you about this. So you come back now with this information, this foresight, this peace of mind. Do you feel more attached to the supernatural? Do you sense things? Do you see spirits, hear God, the angels, anything along those lines?
Oh, it's more of a whisper than a direct. I mean, the more I'm in this world, the further away I get from that world. When I had first come back, yeah, absolutely. I was still 1 foot in that world and 1 foot in this world. And it was kind of a wild show. But the more I became human again, the less that faded into the background. But there's still, like I said in the first chapter of my book, earthquakes and miracles. And if I listen, if I look, I can see them. But more and more, I become just, you know, in tune to, you know, what's the weather like, and it's snowing in Des Moines, and I got to travel through Wichita. What's going on? You know, but it's still there. It's just not. It's more prevalent than it was before I had this experience. I can say that, yeah, because I'm more in tune to it. Because I used to just be more about, you know, what's in it for me. What's the hedonistic, selfish part, and then I've become more selfless than selfish, and still a work in progress, and I think it always will be while I'm here. But I do have a knowledge of what it's really worth. I mean, I've had even had my coworkers just say, you know, Charlie, you don't take things as serious as you used to, and I said, why? You know, let's just, you know, what's going to happen? You know, I'm going to make a blunder at work and I get fired. No big deal. You know, I mean, I'm at the point in my career in my life where, you know, it's like, gee, I can go fishing and play golf. That would be fine with me.
If you don't mind me throwing back for a second, once you were in the hospital and coming out of this, some people that have had near-death experiences, this out-of-body experience aspect, sense things more, see things more in those hours and days afterwards, do you remember any kind of weird connections or strange phenomena that might have taken place in the hospital while you were there?
Oh, yeah. So
please share.
When, so there's one story that I can, I still remember vividly because, I was just getting back to work in recovery. I was able to go in and my company was really good. They said, look, just come in and work a couple hours. You get tired, you go home. I said, great. And so I'd come in and work a couple hours, take a little nap in my car, go home. But one day I had a really good friend of mine, Bob Limo. It was, as I was coming back, he was going down. He had a combination of Crohn's disease and Alzheimer's. He's beginning to lose his mind, but he was in recovery like me. And he just lived a block away from the house. So we would have meetings over at my house. And we called them the Bob and Charlie Ain't Dead Yet meetings. And but Bob was going down as I was coming back. And I was back to work. And there just came a moment where it was like an angel whispered something in my ear. You got to go see Bob. You got to go see Bob now. And I just kind of perked up. I stood up, then, just dropped everything I was doing. I walked out the front door, told the gal up front, says, look, I'm going. I'll be back tomorrow. And I call another guy that I sponsor and asked him, Bob's in the hospital. What hospital is he in? Oh, he's over at Stanford. What room is he in? I don't know. I'll find out. I'll call you right back. I'm heading to Stanford. So I'll go down to Stanford, and by that time, my friend calls me back. He's in room C108, and I find the C block building, and I'm walking there, and I'm walking down the hall, and Bob's wife is stepping out of the room. She looks at me with this really surprised look on her face. She goes, my God, Charlie, I was just praying that we could get a hold of you. Bob's about to die. I just told him it's okay to go, and he needs to see you. And, so I walked in there and here's this guy. Bob was a big old burly biker guy with the, handlebar mustache and bald head, tough guy. He's in there scared to death, literally scared to death. And, hey, Bob, how you doing? Oh, hey, Charlie, good to see you, man. I said, Bob, I love you. He goes, I love you too. And I said, you're pretty scared right now, aren't you? And he's going, yeah, yeah. And I said, well, let me share with you something that was shared to me. He said, pretty soon you're going to be in a place where you're not going to feel any pain or you're not going to be scared. It's all going to be good. And I could just see the anxiety leaving his face. And he started to calm down. I said, and I can tell you, it's going to be just a blink of an eye. I'm going to be over there with you. So rest in comfort, knowing that, your friends are thinking about you, praying for you. It's going to be okay. And, Bob, it's kind of like me. I said, you're feeling better now? He goes, yeah, but I got to go to the bathroom. So we laughed about that a little bit. But Bob passed away, and his wife asked me to say something at his memorial service. And what was going on in between then, I had the opportunity to go over. My son was playing hockey, and he was playing in Phoenix. And so I thought I'd fly over and see him playing hockey, visit my best friend Roger while I'm there. But I realized I'm deathly afraid of flying now. Because the last time I got on an airplane, I went to sleep for 6 weeks. And I noticed there were people like my Russian girlfriend who had this fear of flying, phobias, just to the point that they go into panic attacks. Well, that was me. I'm like, oh, gee, how do I stay awake? What if I go to sleep? What if I don't wake up? Oh, my God. And this voice from Bob was coming to me, Charlie, don't worry about it. You're going to be okay. Because you're right. I am in a good place. But Bob was with me, and I'm talking with him all the time between the time he passed and the time we had his memorial service. It was like he's there. I'm talking to him. He's sitting over in the seat next to me in the passenger side of the car. I could see him. I could talk to him. It's like, Bob, what are you doing here? You're dead. He goes, well, you told me that, you can hang with you for a while. I'm trying to help you get over the fear of flying. And it's okay where you're at. You're right. Wow. You're absolutely right. This thing over here is really a cool place. Thanks for letting me, transition with you. And I can tell you, after I spoke at his memorial service, and half the town of Half Moon Bay showed up because Bob was a phenomenal guy. He helped a lot of men and a lot of people all around Half Moon Bay. And so, you know, really packed memorial service. And afterwards, now, call it foo-foo or not, but as I walked out after the service, there was a group of birds up in a tree that I looked up, and then all of a sudden they just all flew away, and Bob went with them. And the only way I could tell was that Bob was no longer there. He went away with those birds from that tree. I didn't see him again. I didn't talk to him again. Didn't hear from him. But I know his presence is still there. And, you know, as soon as I cross over the other side again, he'll be right there saying, see, I've been waiting for you. It's just been a few seconds.
Do you, I'm curious then, do you believe that when we die, the spirit, the essence of who we are, does it hang out here? Are there ghosts, or are those memory echoes that are tied to us because of the location or the connection that we had to those people in life?
Well, you know, that's kind of drilling down into the depths of what your religious beliefs are. Mine happen to be that we are still here in spirit form, one way or the other. I don't spend too much time worrying about, is it a ghost? Is it, you know, traveling through the cemetery at night or whatever? But I do believe that in the coming end of times, all those that have passed before us will be raised from the dead for a final accounting with those that are lifted up in the rapture. So at one point or the other, and for me, I believe it's kind of coming soon, because there's very few biblical prophecies that have yet to be fulfilled. But you know, whether you're in the ground and the worms are eating you, or you've been burned up and cremated, or whatever your physical body has gone through to transition to the spiritual side, I would say yes, there is a spirit form that's around that, you know, I don't think, you know, it's going to be as night and day as my grandma stopping by on her way to the spirit world. I think, you know, there is a definite division between the spirit world and here, but it's a very thinly veiled separation. And so whether people can go back and forth, I don't know. I just know my own experiences that I've seen. And mostly it's been right around when they first make the transition. I know that was my case, that I was more spiritual than human when I first came back, but slowly over the course of time, I've been more human than spiritual. Don't know if that answers your question. I can just talk about my own experience.
No, I appreciate that. And I know it's everybody's own experience. Do you think, how do you feel about the concept? And Tim and I discussed this, I think, a few weeks back on our show, that what comes next, although may be lorded over by a god or a supreme being or intelligence or universe, whatever name people want to ascribe to it, but that what we experience is what we have created in our own mind's eye of what would come next. Because, you know, you know somebody that saw the devil sitting on a pile of gold. That sounds like and I don't mean this dismissively, but it sounds like a contrived notion of what this person would assume hell would look like. You know, or at least it's being given to him in a representation that he sees it that way. Do you believe that heaven, the afterlife, is a world that will be the matrix that we've already created, the concept of what death or afterlife will look like? Or do you think it's a universal thing and no, we're all going to end up in the same place together?
Somewhere in between, because I'm a firm believer in the Bible, and the Bible says, you know, Jesus came and was God incarnate as a physical human being that showed us the way. In fact, said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to him but by me. Now, that scares a lot of people. I realize that. But, you know, what I do believe is that if you confess with your mouth and your heart and you become a believer, yeah, you will be in that good place that God has set aside for you. Now, me, as I live my life, I kind of imagine I was going to be like that last guy on the cross that would just live in hedonistic, drunken debauchery until the very last minute. Said, okay, Christ, let me in. And I'd get in at the last minute. But, yeah, I'm a firm believer that there is a dark side, that there is a heaven and a hell, because I lived in hell on earth for many years. I know that's a real place, whether it be here on earth or in the afterlife. Now, I don't happen to believe that we're smart enough to concoct it for ourselves. made up in our own mind. I think that those are universal truths that have been around since the dawn of time. And I see, I guess, you know, I'm more attuned, you know, with all this stuff going on in the political world and all the division and hatred and stuff that's going on, whatever side of the aisle we call it, you know, I just see that as getting further and further along through the day when, you know, when Christ comes back and makes everything right once again. Now, you know, I hopefully, I'm a firm believer, I'm on the right side of all of that. So I, you know, I don't worry about being judged, but but I don't think I'm that powerful enough to concoct it in my own mind. I think that that was made when God decided to let there be light.
Let me wrap up the episode with this. For people that are facing death, and we have listeners around the world that listen to this show and in different stages of their life. Some are young but have fear of death like I had for many years. Some are middle age and looking back in this concept and what really comes of life after death, what really exists. What would you tell people right now listening across the world about life and death? What do you think, A, is the biggest life lesson we should put into work right now, and what should we, how should we perceive death? What could you give us on those? And I know those are two huge innocuous questions that could probably take an episode each to answer, but what can you make of it?
You know, what I would suggest, and it may allow me to preach a little bit here, that I get my sustenance from the gospel, and I've helped and show people, or what was pointed out to me is there's one simple thing that you can do as an individual is you take the gospel, and I challenge people, read the book of Matthew and then go and read the book of Acts. Talk about the life of Christ. Read the book of Mark, then go read the book of Acts again. Then read the book of Luke and go read the book of Acts for the third time. Then go read the book of John and then read the book of Acts for the fourth time. Once you get through that, all those questions should be answered in your heart and your soul and your mind. Period. I challenge anybody to do that, and I think the truth will be revealed.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. We're all going to keep our fingers crossed and our thoughts sent out for you that your heart surgery goes well. But thank you for sharing your gift of your story with us. And
yeah,
the book is called Always Remember This Moment. We have a link up for that book and to Charlie's website. We appreciate the conversation, Charlie. Thank you so much.
You know, one real quick note is that there's another website. There's the book website that you can get from www.charlesgardnerauthor.com.
Okay.
CharlesGardnerAuthor, which takes you to both books. You can order the books. They'll come through me. I'll send you a signed copy.
Perfect.
Cool.
Then you've already set the goal that you'll be here to sign those books for people. Because I know you're not going to let these people down now.
If not, maybe it'll be a ghostwriter that signs it.
Charlie, thank you so much. That's it for this week, folks. We will be back with brand new episodes. And I know tomorrow you're expecting there's going to be an episode of Holzer's Ghosts. There is not. I am busily filming right now for a special. I can't say any more than that. And it is not Holzer's related, but it is another interesting paranormal special that I'm working on. That will hopefully air a little later on this year. So bear that in mind, and I'll be gone this week. I won't be able to do a live stream for Holzer's Ghosts, but I will be back next week with Holzer's Ghosts and new episodes there. So that's it for this week. We'll be back next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday with the best in true crime and paranormal talk radio. For that guy, I'm this guy, and you've been listening to Darkness Radio.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.